You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on April 3rd, 1882, and August the 15th, 1951, and thereafter. While history records the death of Jesse James at the hands of Robert Ford, there are many that believe his ending remains unresolved. Vanished is mixed in stereo surround and is best experienced using headphones. If you have a pair handy, put them on now.
In presenting this booklet, I wish to say that I do so with the utmost sincerity in an effort to establish facts after exhaustive research and to give documented proof that the man who lived under the name J. Frank Dalton from 1882 until 1951 was in fact Jesse Woodson James, whose name was emblazoned in history due to his activities with Quantrill's guerrillas during and after the Civil War, and is head of the highly publicized James Gang. Many times it has been written that Jesse W. James was shot and killed in St. Joseph, Missouri on April 3, 1882 by Robert Ford, presumed to have been an acquaintance. I have obtained information on the family trees of both the James and Ford families, which indicates it is highly doubtful that a Ford would have murdered a James, but we'll go into the proof later in this booklet. I have painstakingly researched into the life of Jesse W. James and did not take previously written books and newspaper accounts for granted. I covered more than 90,000 miles in the 2 years from early 1948 until the end of 1950, and am still traveling as new information develops. I personally was in charge of the care of Jesse W. James, alias J. Frank Dalton, at Merrimack Caverns, Stanton, Missouri, except when I was away on research, as he revealed information on his past to me from 1948 to 1951. I am convinced that Jesse W. James was not killed April 3, 1882, and that to free him when the price of $10,000 was put upon his head as a fugitive from the law, another man was killed in his place, under a planned hoax. This was the knowledge of Jesse James himself, his immediate family, and other members of the gang. He did not reveal his true identity until he was 100 years old, keeping an oath taken in 1882 by all living members of the gang. By 1948, he was immune to the death penalty by man's law, his mind clear, though he was restive under the handicap of a broken hip. With this foreword, I present facts not published heretofore, and I submit that Jesse Woodson James lived until just 3 weeks prior to his 104th birthday. He died in 1951 at Granbury, Texas, and there he lies buried.
Some of the stories we cover for the show take a toll. You get into something, and you think it's for a little while, and you end up being swallowed by your fascination and taken down rabbit holes you never thought you'd be in. Over the years, we've received a ton of requests for us to cover one story in particular. Ever since we took that pit stop in 1865 to visit the story of John Wilkes Booth, the fever has been burning. Our next story is a monster with so many twists and turns that theory and fact seem to have become transparent. What a fun place to begin. It's important for us to convey the history of our subjects in a way that allows our audience a deeper understanding of their historical significance. And perhaps no other case will convey that better than our next subject. We're about to explore the life, legacy, infamy, and history of perhaps the biggest outlaw to ever live. This is a story of what happened, or didn't, on April the 3rd, 1882, in St. Joseph, Missouri, and how a figure clouded in polarization could become even more polarizing after his death, when in 1951, another man arrives on the scene in Granbury, Texas, far from where he made his name, claiming to be the real Jesse James. What happens when theory casts a shadow on history? Our next subject is known by many names. Icon. Outlaw. Legend. Robin Hood. Murderer. But who was Jesse James really? And could his story have lasted far longer than history officially records? Oh, and one more thing. If Jesse James was ever in Granbury, maybe he ran into a certain other figure that we've discussed extensively on this show. You'd be surprised at what you can uncover when you follow the evidence wherever it leads. Welcome back to Vanished, in our multi-part series on the outlaw, Jesse James. It's been about 5 months since we revisited the Amelia Earhart case, and we are back with you now. Welcome back to Vanished. My name is Chris Williamson, and with me, as always, is the voice of reason around here, Mrs. Jennifer Taylor. How you doing, counselor?
Hey. Also, it's been longer than 5 months. I don't know where you pulled out 5 months, but it's been far longer than 5 months.
I looked at the numbers. I think I'm right. That's about when we recorded for Earhart.
Okay.
Okay. Like most cases that make the show, this one has been on our radar for some time. We are about to get into a story that is, every time I think we can't top the crazy, I'm pleasantly surprised. The story has everything. At the center of it is a man that has very much captivated a generation. When you think of the Wild West, you think Jesse James. And I think as we step into discussion, listeners of this show will certainly see some similar themes to another case we covered that Jen has strong opinions on, and John Wilkes Booth. In fact, if certain stories are to be believed, one may have had a hand in the demise of the other. Have you heard of that, Jen?
I had not heard that.
All right. All right. Well, we are not alone as we enter our dive on Jesse James. As we begin tonight, I thought it might be fun to switch it up and have our opening conversation and bring in a mutual friend, a now two-time collaborator for the show, Mr. Adam Ballinger of Graveyard Tales. Welcome back, sir. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always an honor. I feel bad for y'all that I've been on twice, but you know, I'm looking forward to this.
And yeah, absolutely. I will ask you, as we start tonight, I know people have certainly asked Graveyard Tales to cover the James story. I thought it was a natural collaborative fit for us to do it. What's your initial overall thought about, you know, his legacy and his reach? I mean, my God, he seems to touch everything conspiratorial.
On the surface, you know, you don't think that it's as wild as it is, but when you get to kind of digging down into it, you realize that he's not just the quote pretty face you've seen in pop culture. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. And like you said, he's got his hand in a lot of stuff that I personally didn't realize until I started looking into it.
Jen, how has it been for you? We've started production on this now. We are covering it. We are working with our guests now as this will unfold for listeners over the next few weeks. What are your initial thoughts coming into this case? Is it striking to you for anything in particular, or are you just interested in covering the story?
It's a really fun case. You know, I really like the time period, and this is our third case now where we've covered this exact late 19th century. Of course, Jack the Ripper was across the pond.
Yeah.
In Europe.
Yes.
And then we did cover John Wilkes Booth. It's interesting because as Lincoln is assassinated and the war is winding down, of course, we'll talk about this, I'm sure, but the James Younger gang, they really have their origins in the Civil War.
Yeah.
But as the Civil War is dying down and kind of as John Wilkes Booth's story is wrapping up, the James Younger gang story is really getting started. It's definitely a wild one. Super interesting.
Yeah.
And a lot of uncertainty. so much uncertainty because John Wilkes Booth was a famous actor.
Right.
Right. So everybody knew what he looked like. Everybody knew his name.
Right.
He at least traveled in respectable society, although he ultimately ended up being a criminal.
Yeah.
But these people were just criminals through and through. They were not a part of, you know, mainstream culture. They, by their very nature of what they did, they were able to hide their identities very well.
Yeah.
Disguise themselves very well. So it's really interesting trying to figure out what actually happened in a lot of these instances. Mm-hmm. We don't even know. He was never, we'll get into it, but he was never charged with anything. So we don't know. I guess we really can't even say for sure which crimes he actually committed.
Right.
All of this, I'd never really realized. I thought how much is just kind of educated guessing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously there are a lot of Booth similarities here. I think one very distinct difference between John Wilkes Booth and Jesse James is in the capability. What I like about the idea of him not dying in 1882 in St. Joseph is that he had the ability to pull it off. He had the experience to pull it off. When you get right down to it, the claims that are going to be made here during the show, during this story, are that he simply did what he always did. He only did it one more time. And we'll see how well that particular story holds up and what we can do with it. I think I know what you think, but what do you think about these stories? I mean, is this not deja vu?
It has a parallel to when we cover John Wilkes Booth, because it's the same idea. I think it speaks to the time period.
Mm-hmm.
The Civil War was a very, very divisive time, and there were a lot of hurt feelings after the war wrapped up. I mean, you have to understand, so many people were disenfranchised, because if you were a Confederate, whether you fought or not, you oftentimes lost your right to vote and lost your right to hold office, especially in the northern states. And so it doesn't surprise me that some of these Confederate heroes, if you want to call John Wilkes Booth that, he assassinated Abraham Lincoln thinking he was doing it for Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
And that's its own, how much Richmond was involved. That could be its own podcast. But he certainly sympathized with the South.
Right.
The same can certainly be said about Jesse James.
Right.
So I think that what's interesting is there's this common thread of there are these Confederate heroes that have died. And in one way or another, especially in the South, it's not a coincidence, I think, that in both of these stories, whether it's the John Wilkes Booth escape theory or the Jesse James escape theory, they always come south and they always live a life in Texas or in Oklahoma. That's always what happens. And I think it speaks more to the culture in Reconstruction era than it does actually what happened.
Yeah, that's a powerful point as we start off. Adam, thoughts on that? This is a guy that, as Jen said, I mean, I've said it, not his whole life, but a lot of his life is a smokescreen.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Even the disagreements over what photos are true photos
right.
of the real Jesse James. Again, it's a repeated theme, but there's so much we don't know. But in this case, practically, there's so much we don't know, too. I mean, what does that do for theory? I mean, it just allows it to sort of explode in stories like this, no?
Yeah, and I think one of the main differences between Booth and James that I've seen from listening to y'all's Booth episodes to this one is Jesse James basically had his own PR guy in the newspaper, so he was able to spin his legacy and his deeds a certain way, where Booth really didn't.
Yeah.
Booth had some people that really loved him, and then everybody else just hated him.
Yeah.
But Jesse James was able to, I think I saw where he paid off the news guy or something, was friends with him and was able to get fluff pieces written.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were saying, there's a lot of mystery about what he actually did.
Yeah.
Oh, he robbed this bank and got away with this money, and then the paper spun it to, well, he's just taking the rich man's money. We're not rich.
Yeah.
So it's good. And made up this whole thing about the Robin Hood of the Wild West.
Right.
Like you're saying, there's this huge mystery in what he did. But I also noticed, and I can kind of sympathize with this maybe because I am a Texas boy or whatever, but we romanticize the Wild West.
Yeah.
And we romanticize the criminals and the white hat wearing cowboys.
Yeah.
Cowboys and Indians,
mm-hmm.
All of that Yeah. Tombstone, the movie.
Absolutely.
That's like, you know, yeah, this is, and even back then it was romanticized. There were dime novels that were coming out. Mm-hmm. There were traveling shows about what it was like. Even as it was happening, it was being romanticized. This is certainly not something that this is a modern thing. We're right. romanticizing the past. From the very beginning, it really was portrayed as like this glamorous lifestyle, even though it certainly was not.
No.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think 1921, if I remember correctly, is when Jesse James first, quote, starred, you know, had somebody playing him in a film.
Yeah.
So it goes all the way back to 1921. Yeah. I think we have the misconception of the Wild West being a long, long time ago.
Right.
I know growing up I did. But really, it was the late 1800s, early 1900s were not that long ago in the grand scheme.
Right.
Of
things. Yeah. Right.
So 1921, my great-grandparents had already been born.
Mm-hmm.
They got to see the end of the Wild West and then into this. So, like you said, that early, you've got people romanticizing what Jesse James did. And I think it all has to do with that PR guy that he mm-hmm. had. And maybe if Booth had had a better PR guy, then it would have been a whole different story today, you know?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Booth had the vice president.
Ah, that's a good
That's
point.
A shout out to Dave.
Well,
that's a shout out to Dave Taylor. That's right, Dave Taylor. No, I'm just messing with you.
What I think is interesting, too, about this relationship he had with the media, you contrast it against Booth, but another way you can contrast it against Booth is that Booth was proud of what he did. He stood up on a stage full of people. He wrote a little manifesto. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a PR guy, but he had his book that he tore out all the pages and wrote his little manifesto. He wrote a letter, then he handed it to somebody that worked at the theater. Mm-hmm. I believe it was at the theater. Dave's going to kill me if I get any tiny fact wrong on Booth. But he wanted people to know what he did and why he did it. And when you have James writing to the media, it's a lot of, I was not there. I've got 8 witnesses that can tell you I was somewhere mm-hmm. else. And you know what? I would turn myself in if I thought I would get a fair trial, but I'm not going to get a fair trial. Mm-hmm. He always, always, always denied any wrongdoing,
right.
Which is interesting because, yeah, I mean, Jesse James, like, of course he's famous outlaw, but not according to Jesse James.
Right.
He never did mm-hmm. anything.
Yeah. You know, Adam talking about the romanticizing of the character and of just the Wild West in general, what I will state right off the bat here is that it's difficult not to be swallowed up by the myth that surrounds the story and really Jesse's life. You know, surprisingly, mm-hmm. we've covered our fair share of murder on this show, but this guy might be the most cold-blooded killer we've ever discussed. And isn't that saying something? I mean, he's certainly in the running.
That was one thing that hit me when I was looking into stuff. I know y'all will get into it later, but what kind of struck me was that he had joined the Bushwhackers because of his early life. The guy that he was under was said to be one of the most ruthless killers of the time
yeah.
and was decimating Union soldiers and Union sympathizers.
Massacres.
Yeah.
With a name like Bloody Bill Anderson.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can understand how that kind of a person molding this kid. I mean, at the time, he's a kid,
yeah.
you know, for all intents and purposes. This is a kid we're talking about. It.
And
his brother.
Brother.
Sure.
Yep. Yeah.
That's the thing. Yeah. He was so young.
Yeah.
A baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a baby.
So he was very influenced by that guy. And I think that's kind of what led into his later
mm-hmm.
actions. He hadn't fully come into his own as a person by the time he joined the Bushwhackers, and they molded him into this psycho,
mm-hmm.
basically, able to do what he had to do to get done what he wanted to get done.
Violence was a part of every fiber of his life. I think the two interesting points among many in his life that I really want to point out, one is the attack on him as a teen, you know, where he's ambushed and his stepfather is but strung mm-hmm. up, and it's a really brutal assault.
Yeah.
May of 1863. And the other is the Pinkerton raid, which we'll discuss here in a bit.
Yeah.
Those two events go a long way in helping us understand ongoing motivations, maybe a little bit of his psyche. His psyche is what we're going to get into with a couple of really special guests coming up during our investigation, but I think it'll be fun to talk about that and kind of how a psyche can be shaped and how that can affect the actions of somebody like a Jesse James.
Something I think we lose sight of when we talk about how brutal he was is we're looking at it through the lens of today.
Mm-hmm.
The Wild West was a little more rough and tumble in general. You know, you had what you would consider upstanding citizens mm-hmm. that were capable of more brutality than probably most of us are today, just because of how harsh the conditions were, what they had to do. So then when you say somebody like James was a brutal killer for the time,
mm-hmm.
I think that should put a little bit of emphasis on that, because everybody was hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody had to do some tough stuff that we would go, I don't know that I want to do that, you know?
Yeah.
Especially in the middle of the war.
I mean,
they were bushwhackers, which if you don't know what that means, they fought for the South, but they weren't a part of the Confederate Army. They would join these groups of people that were essentially standalone fighters. They weren't acting under the Confederate military. They weren't a part of any bigger organization. They were just, I hate to use this word because it's very charged, but they were basically terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They would go around doing whatever they wanted and inflicting brutality on people in the name of the South. There's a lot of discussion, and I think a lot of interesting discussion on wartime do's and don'ts and how much of it can be excused because it was a war, but then at the same time, they're not acting, you know, they're not wearing uniforms, they're not subject to discipline in the military. It's a really interesting conversation, but it was a very, when I say it was a very divisive time, like, we live in a divisive time, but this is something that I think was even beyond anything that anyone alive today could possibly understand.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
And so that definitely played into that too. And it also played into why they eventually kind of transitioned into a life of crime. Because like I said, once you've spent your youth doing what they did, you know you're never going to be able to re-enter society, right? You're not, unless you can get it, like, you know, you're not going to be able to vote. You're not going to be able to hold office. Everyone already sees you as a criminal. So really, what choice do you have?
Right.
Not justifying any of it, but I do feel like this is what they felt. They felt that, you know, they've already kind of gone down this path, and this is the path that they're on, living outside of the law and living outside of society.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think that's a good question to ask, too, as, you know, I think as anybody that investigates this story of any kind, or in any way, I should say, the idea of why he was doing the things that he was doing, the motivation behind it, and the way he saw himself, and the way he viewed his vision, his message, or what he believed in, what he was standing up for. You know, that's another similarity to Booth. I mean, Booth believed with every fiber of his being in what he was doing. I think Jesse James is very similar in his thinking. I think, again, we'll talk about some psychology as we go forward, but I think if you compare the two, you would see some similarities in some of the ways of thinking.
Well, I think another thing they both have in common is that, yes, they had certainly some ideological motivation, but I think both the James Younger gang as a group and then also John Wilkes Booth, I think a lot of it did have to do with the individual. Like, John Wilkes Booth was certainly a narcissist. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, he was motivated by his hate for Abraham Lincoln. He was motivated politically in some sense, but he was also just a huge narcissist. And I think the same is probably true of Jesse and Frank James.
Sure.
Yes, they were somewhat motivated by their politics and by their past, but I think a lot of it was just very, very personal and selfish. Frankly, like, he had this Robin Hood reputation, but I don't know of any credible account of him actually redistributing wealth.
No.
That he was doing this all for him and his personal motivations rather than just being a lost cause hero. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some other criminals around the same time that I would say embodied the Robin Hood thing more than Jesse James.
Because,
you know, they would rob and then maybe they didn't distribute money, but they would do stuff for their town, or they would hold big banquets for the town, feed the people.
Yeah.
I certainly haven't dived as deep into James as y'all have, but I haven't seen where he was taking that money and doing anything for anybody but him and his gang.
That's part of the myth.
Yeah. That was all perpetuated by those news articles that were written while he was still alive.
By his PR team.
Exactly.
I love that you called it his PR team, because that's absolutely what it was.
Jen, I know you want to cover some aspects of the Pinkerton raid. I want to do that as well. I don't want to say it sets up what happens here, but I think it's a good starting point for the story. I don't want to tell the story chronologically from his birth or anything like that. We'll get into some of the stuff with some of our guests, but I do want to talk about the Pinkerton raid and sort of that as a turning point. I do want to ask you before we get into it, though, the idea of Dalton, Frank Dalton, which we're going to get to, and the idea that Jesse James did not die in 1882. This is obviously not uncharted waters for us. We have dealt with this very topic before. Again, lots and lots of similarities. We'll call them out as we go. Is there anything different in the way you're approaching this particular story, the way we're doing it now, years after we covered Booth, or is it pretty much it's got to do the same thing to sway you when it comes to reasonable doubt?
No, I don't think there's anything too different about how I look at it. I mean, the claims are very, very similar in that you have certain mm-hmm. people claiming that they are Jesse James or that they know someone who's Jesse James and that the person that we thought died on such and such date, whether it be Booth or James, that they didn't and they lived on under an alias. Like, I mean, at the heart of it is the same story.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And they're not the only two people in the Wild West that have that story. It's a recurring theme. But at the end of the day, the question is the same. Like, how do we know that the person who died is the person who died, mm-hmm. right? So maybe in certain cases, it might be more difficult. There are things that make it difficult on both stories. So for John Wilkes Booth, it was a very, very political and highly publicized event. And there were a lot of people that knew who he was, and there were a lot of high emotions involved. And so when they took his body, they put it somewhere where people really couldn't get to it. Mm-hmm. And so because of the secrecy surrounding the identification of the body and the doctors that examined him, that's going to sow distrust. Even though there were people at the Garrett Farm that could identify him, I mean, they didn't know him, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, well, what identifying markings do you remember? Things like that. Whereas in Jesse James, we had a public inquest. We had his entire family identify him, his wife. So we don't have that aspect in the Booth case, but we do kind of have this, as we've already discussed, just kind of by nature, he was someone that no one really knew what he looked like mm-hmm. because he didn't want people knowing what he looked like. Mm-hmm. And there's just kind of this automatic distrust of like, how sure are you that you shot Jesse James? Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different in terms of like, why do we distrust it? But the evidence, you're looking for the same kind of thing. Like, are there identifying markings? Are there people that knew the person mm-hmm. that identified them? How credible is the person coming forward saying that they think that they have a different theory and they can prove it? All of that stuff is the same, no matter who you're looking at. And we've kind of taken the same approach no matter what case we're covering, even with our Amelia Earhart stuff. Yeah. And, you know, other things that we've covered. It really all is the same. You know, like, what evidence does somebody have when you're making an extraordinary claim? Do you have evidence to back it up?
Yeah. Well, we will see. One standout event that I did want to talk about, I just mentioned earlier, is the Pinkerton raid. I will give a very oversimplification, a short version of it. There's not a whole lot to it, really. This is the night of January the 25th, 1875. This takes place in Kearney, Missouri. That's where the James Farm is located. Missouri winters, I can attest to this, they're blistering cold. It's a snowy landscape. Inside the farmhouse are three occupants: Zerelda Samuels, who is the mother of Jesse and Frank James, her husband, Dr. Reuben Samuels, and Jesse's half-brother, 9 years old at the time, Archie. Jesse and Frank are not there, so it's very, very important to note the James boys are not there at the time of this attack. Outside, agents of the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, who listeners of our Booth series will be very familiar with, approach the home, and they think they are there. They've got sort of an outdated tip, and they're there because they are hired by some of the railroad and banking interests with whom the James boys had robbed. Agents approach the home. They pop either... Did they pop a smoke bomb or a hand grenade? Even there's not an agreement on that.
It was like a smoke bomb. It was, in my mind, it almost... It's not a Molotov cocktail, but it's similar.
Yeah.
It's a smoke bomb.
Okay, so we're going to say a smoke bomb. They throw it through the window, shatters glass, of course. Presumably, they want to smoke the boys out, but it lands in the hearth where there's a fire going, and it blows the home pretty much all to hell, severely injuring Zerelda. She loses a part of her arm in the attack. Ruben's also injured. He's really shaken pretty bad. But little Archie is closest to the heart of the blast, and he's killed as a result. That is the short version of the events of the Pinkerton raid. And I think it's interesting that it was a little bit of an outdated tip. The James boys had fled the home. They were not there. That was something that they normally did. They were just on the move. And as a result, this sort of changed everything, not only for Jesse James himself, but it also changed everything for how the public would see Jesse James, how they would view him. It really boosted support for him talking about politics. The politics were politicking at that point as a result of this raid. Jen, comments on that?
It was certainly a big turning point in their lives and in the whole timeline. It wasn't the first time that they had run-ins with Pinkerton agents.
Right.
About a year prior, they had actually murdered a man named Joseph Witcher. The Pinkerton Detective Agency had this long-standing rivalry with the James Younger gang. The Pinkertons they worked for the express companies. And so if you're not familiar with what that is, it's basically a way of sending packages. It's like UPS, right? FedEx of the day. And that was their job, because back then the post office did not send parcels. They only sent letter mail. And so if you wanted to send packages, if you wanted to send money, a lot of companies out in the West that had to pay their workers, they would get their payroll from these express deliveries. So anyway, these were companies that would, they would rent out cars, and they had business connections and business relationships with the railroad, so that there would always be an express car, right, on the railroad. Obviously, you needed quite a bit of security when you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars, or maybe, you know, maybe not quite that much, but in today's money, it was certainly a lot of money, know, like in these safes. In addition to robbing banks, the James Younger gang was notorious for robbing the express cars on these trains. And the Pinkertons were hired by a lot of these express companies to, you know, track down these robberies. Right. To provide security and all of that. They never caught Jesse James. They never caught Frank James. And it was just this long-standing rivalry that started long before the Pinkerton raid. Like I said, the year before, an operative named Joseph Witcher had gone undercover to try and ferret them out. And the James brothers found out who he was, killed him, left his body to be found. They already had a rivalry with the Pinkertons. This did not start that, but it certainly ignited it, because Jesse and Frank would absolutely never forgive what happened to their brother and their mother. It turned it into something that was pure hate. From that point on, Jesse was out for blood, and he was out for revenge, and he wasn't going to stop until he got everybody that was involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Adam, he's already a cold-blooded killer at the time of this raid. What does that do to a cold-blooded killer? It dials it up to 11, and it's not romanticizing, but it ties into the romanticizing that you're talking about earlier. You're talking about a guy that was, you know, the Robin Hood type figure and all of this myth that's built up around him. Well, now he's got this sympathy that's playing out politically and, you know, as it's happening in real life. What does that do to someone like that? How can that fuel someone like that?
Like you said, he was already a cold-blooded killer. You mess with anybody's family, it's going to rile them up, whether they're a cold-blooded killer or not. Well, all you did was poke the hornet's nest, really.
Right.
It did it on a couple different sides. Yeah. Like you said, politically, the Missouri State Legislature tried to pass a bill on his behalf, offering him amnesty because of what the Pinkerton agents did to him. It might be, again, that the PR thing, but it kind of makes the Pinkerton agents look like the bumbling cops of the day and makes him look like this misunderstood guy that they're going too hard on.
It's the Waco. It is the Waco of the 19th century. That is 100% what it is.
Basically, you've got the bad guy already that's doing bad things. And because of the Pinkerton agents going as hard as they did, it backfired. 100% backfired on them.
Yeah.
It turned the tides where maybe if they had gone about it a different way, the public would be on the Pinkerton side. But because of them blowing up the mom and the brother, it just forced the hand, I guess, of Jesse, because he ended up, if I'm not mistaken, he not only killed the agent, but then turned around and killed his mom's neighbor, because apparently either he was involved or Jesse thought he was involved in the tip.
Yeah, the violence extended to, we'll talk about a specific incident with a guest who he was relative of a conductor, a train conductor, who he believed was in on the Pinkerton raid and helped get them intel on where the farm was located. Mm-hmm. So he was killed for his troubles for that. Again, but there's a lot of myth building around, well, did these events actually tie together? Is this one big story? Are they isolated incidents? Are there simpler explanations for certain events? We have certain events that are standout events in his life and raids that he was supposedly a part of and not confirmed to be a part of. It's really interesting how we're still trying to dissect what this man's true history was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a breeding ground for this kind of a story that we're going to tell, for someone like a Frank Dalton to enter the picture 70 years later and claim, yes, I was Jesse James. And I don't know about you, but the difference between this and Booth is Jen and I stood right next to the gravesite in Granbury, Texas that says Jesse Woodson James on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very real. It's a very real thing. This is a part of history that's
a very real tourist trap.
Yeah.
Maybe so. Or is it just a neat story? That's what I'm going to attempt to try to show. Same thing that I tried to do with Booth. Can I show enough to make listeners go, well, that is interesting. That is compelling. That is, I think, my biggest hope entering this story. It is like deja vu, and it is very similar, and there will be very similar themes. But I think, you know, this is my second shot to see if I can redo Booth and maybe sell it a little bit differently this time. We'll see.
You're talking about the Granbury grave. That kills me. I mean, I honestly don't know how to feel about it.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like a tourist trap.
Yeah.
It is a tourist trap.
Yeah. Everything around it and the investigation that was done on
yeah.
the guy that was hired to do an excavation of that grave to see if it was James.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I don't have to go any further because James wasn't an amputee and this guy was an amputee. So it's obviously not. And then everybody involved in hiring him was like, well, maybe the ground shifted the grave.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, if we're going that route, then the most logical thing is they put that marker over another grave.
Sure.
Tourist trap. But anyway,
that's what it is.
Yeah. The guy initially said, I don't want to do this excavation. I'll do it if a court orders me to do it, but I don't want to do this because it's part of Granbury lore.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a hand in messing up Granbury lore.
Right.
And so I think he knew even then that I don't think this is going anywhere and I don't want to be known as the guy that screwed it up for Granbury.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't stop laughing when I read, oh, maybe the ground shifted this monument over or the grave over.
Yeah.
I know Texas. We don't have that great a ground shift to cause that to happen. You have to be on a fault line for it to shift.
Especially not in North Texas. Yeah.
No. No.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Well, we are not cutting that, Chris. You better not.
No, I think, you know, look, it's an excellent point. I think, look, as we tell the story, again, I'm not surprised, but another Booth parallel, you know, this was a real case. There was an excavation. They tested remains. This has been done.
Mm-hmm.
As it relates to this particular case that we're going to talk about, it has been done. We have had some legitimate results, but theory lives on. And I think that is compelling in and of itself to talk about why that is, why it just won't go away. It's a fun story, and it's got, depending on what road you go down, we have Templar treasure and lost diaries and the fucking mummies floating around out there somewhere still. And mm-hmm.
Wait, are we allowed to say fuck?
Yes. This is our show. God damn it.
I didn't realize we were using explicit tags because I've, you know, if that's
we
allowed.
Need street cred, Jen. Okay, so you got to drop a fuck every once in a while.
Every now and then just throw it in.
Well, yeah, I mean, hey, even PG-13 shows get one fuck.
That's true.
We get one. Did you just steal it?
He did. He took it from you.
I did. I think I took it this time.
He just claimed it.
You can have it next time.
Okay.
I found an interesting thing I was going to tell y'all, and y'all can leave it in, take it out, whatever. But in looking up Jesse James in pop culture, I don't know if y'all found this or not, but in the Pokemon anime series. They actually have two antagonists that are named Jesse and James. They changed it from the Japanese names to when it got to America, it's Jesse and James. The people who were writing the English script like Jesse James so much. So even Pokemon has ties to Jesse James somehow.
That's wild.
Which I thought was wild.
As we get into the story, as we get into this, I would encourage everybody to look up your own stuff. Do your own research. We will have links to lots of stuff that we will fill out the show notes with. We are going to take this to trial. We're going to do what we do with a couple of guys who, this is sort of in their wheelhouse. And I think it's going to be a really fun back and forth between history as it's written and an alternate history that we're going to try to present with hopefully some sound evidence and some interesting, compelling documentation and testimony and all that jazz to back it up. And we'll see how well it does. I think it's going to be exciting, and I'm looking forward to getting into this case finally. It's been a long time coming. Jen, closing thoughts. I'll give you the floor to close it out.
Yeah, I've pretty much won every trial we've done, and I'm looking forward to winning another one.
God, it's cold out here when you're by yourself. All right, let's get started. When we opened Season 2 with Jack the Ripper, it marked the first time we really discussed a psychological angle on the show. We've got some pretty interesting individuals in the archives now, and all of them have been posthumously studied in an effort to try and gain perspective on their minds. What makes a man like Jesse James? Of all the subjects we've ever covered, perhaps he, more than anyone, has the most interesting makeup. And that got me thinking, just how much does that makeup and the experience of his life shaped the man and how we see him? The mind of a killer can be a dangerous place. So let's start by exploring that with a pair of doctors that are about to paint a picture for you that will give you a real peek behind the icy cold blue eyes of Jesse James.
I didn't realize this before we started research, but Jesse James is probably one of the most tragic figures that we've ever covered for the show, in the sense of sort of him being a victim of like this immense amount of violence from a very young age. I'm certainly not making excuses for what he chooses to do with that life ultimately. What I am saying, though, is that we have to consider the circumstances. So let's start by doing that. From a general standpoint, what is growing up around all of that brutality in that time do to shape the young mind of Jesse James?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. One of the things that I would want to say as we move into a discussion like this is that you have to take everything into context, including the time.
Sure.
And how children were viewed and how gender role norms were viewed, which are very different from today. And children are viewed very different from today. Mm-hmm. Childhood mortality rates were incredibly high at that time, as opposed to now. There's a term we use in working with children and families called ACEs, A-C-E, adverse childhood experiences. And so we have a little bit of a more of an accurate modern understanding of the impact of events on children. And when you look at just some of the basic stuff that we were reviewing to be able to talk to you today, we're talking about death of a father very early on. Sure. And then mom is so stressed out financially, she has to give them up. So they're given up and put in an orphanage or some sort of foster home situation, which, you know, there was no oversight at all. So who even knows what he could have been exposed to at that time?
Sure.
And he comes back into this newly blended family, and the new member of the family, he witnesses being brutalized and tortured by militiamen that were for the other side of the Civil War. Like, they already represented what were supposed to be the bad guys. And then he witnesses his father being tortured, and then he gets beaten up himself. So yeah, we're starting off with some real programming there.
Yeah.
I think there's also this idea of surviving, like you have to survive. And what do you hold on to if everything else has been taken away from you? And what you had was the Confederate ideology.
Dr. Shiloh and Dr. Scott are the highly decorated hosts behind LA Not So Confidential, a true crime podcast with a specific specialty in forensic psychology. Dr. Scott holds a doctoral degree in clinical psychology from Antioch University, Santa Barbara, a master's degree in clinical psychology from Antioch University, Los Angeles, and a dual major BA from Birmingham Southern College. Dr. Shiloh is a law enforcement psychologist in Los Angeles where she provides clinical services, organizational consultation, and training, and is part of the crisis negotiation team there. She's a former terrorism liaison officer specializing in forensic psychology for her private practice. These two are uniquely suited to do for us what they always do, help us make sense of the man at the center of our investigation.
Shiloh, he's 16 when he becomes a bushwhacker, running with Bloody Bill Anderson, who, listen, we'll have show notes, but Anderson's brutality is, it's a thing of horror. For someone that's, again, that young, just a few years removed from the incident that Scott was just talking about, again, experiencing so much violence, running with someone like Anderson's got to dial it up to 11 at 16, no?
It's interesting. I mean, with the foundation that Dr. Scott just laid out, I mean, that could be the start of so many different things. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could totally jump to conclusions and say, yeah, this is where psychopathy starts, or this is where antisocial personality starts. I think in reviewing the behavior in sort of these adolescent years and who he's running with and the choices he's making and what he's doing, what popped into my head and I started thinking about is what we see with gang culture and like organized crime / terrorists of a community and looking at the overlap there, you know, taking what we know in contemporary times and kind of looking backwards, because I mean that we have to kind of go from both ends of this candle, right? Yeah. Like explore what we know about him and extrapolate that and maybe work backwards to what we know now. You're talking about things that overlap with the psychology behind gang members and the behaviors that they engage in. And we're talking about some of this stuff as well, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about traumatic backgrounds and perhaps some mental health issues, as well as just what is my identity? And if I am kind of left to my own devices and or have to latch onto some older folks in the community being, you know, maybe in their 20s or 30s, what is being modeled for me when I didn't even have those basic needs met for me and those attachments met for me as a child?
Right.
The adolescent years are really pivotal for just your normal person. Mm. But if this is the time when he starts engaging in this behavior with someone who is older than him, you know, you kind of see how it's off and running. He didn't really have a chance.
Yeah. Jesus. That's sad. It really is when you think that's the foundation for what we're going to get into. I was surfing YouTube the other night and I'd seen this before, but there's a really great Batman documentary called The Psychology of the Dark Knight. I don't know if either of you have ever seen it. It's excellent.
I'm sure Scott has.
Excellent stuff. And, you know, in it, they discuss how like witnessing his parents, the violent murder of his parents, you know, it sets off a chain reaction of events in Bruce Wayne's life. And of course, the rest is history. They say there's like a moment, it's like flipping a switch and it ties to, I guess, one's greater ideals, maybe morality. You can let dark moments sort of shape you. You can choose to go one way or another. I think Jesse James is like a prime example of what happens when you take a larger than life reputation, like he's now gained, and use it for nefarious means. He was doing that at the time. I think that's really interesting. We'll get into some of the politics tonight, but taking that violent upbringing and choosing kind of which way you want to walk with it.
Yeah. I was just going to comment, and this is something that Dr. Shiloh and I refer to a lot on our show, is that no one ever snaps, despite the fact that there are television shows that are named Snapped, that it is a sort of an idea or a meme in true crime. And what we know from research and really great thought leaders in the field, in our profession, who specifically have expertise in risk assessment and threat management, is that the journey to violence is an evolutionary process. Mm-hmm. And there may be a whole bunch of factors that are involved in whether or not someone will go that way. And I'm gonna leave that over to Dr. Shiloh, because she's way more elegant in the way she describes all of the factors that come to bear into whether or not someone becomes a psychopath or acts in antisocial behaviors. Because that's really important, is to discern out what are the behaviors versus what are the internal motivators, right?
Yeah.
Because there's a really great video online that's an interview with a former CIA agent. It's either CIA or FBI, really well-spoken woman who's retired. And she talks about working in debriefing with terrorists who have been taken into custody. And she talks about how one of the most poignant things that was said to her by a very, very embedded terrorist is, he was saying, look at you Americans, your biggest movies are Star Wars or their fantasies, or their things about being the independent rebel who fights against the oppressive regime. And that's what draws all of our fighters in. And here you are sitting across from me trying to tell me I'm doing something bad when you yourself are the oppressor. And so she wasn't saying that to justify any types of horrific actions, but she was saying we have to understand the mindset and the context and the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time in which these things occur. So when we talk about Jesse James being a terrorist, I don't really know, like that gets tossed around a lot in the most recent literature. It's kind of quaint as compared to what we would call a terrorist today. Yeah. And that was one of the problems I had with Stiles's work. And Stiles is really well written.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a deeper dive into that book, but he throws around a real justification for Jesse to be described as a terrorist. And I don't know if that fits.
Yeah. Dr. Shiloh, you were a terrorism liaison officer. This is your wheelhouse. Jen said it in the opening of the show that the James Younger gang, you know, she didn't like the word, but she did use the word terrorist for all intents and purposes when you get right down to it. Do you want to add to that? I mean, what are your thoughts on using that term to, I guess, to describe the actions of a James Younger gang so long ago?
Yeah, we have to kind of look at the definitions we do have now. You know, I used it earlier to sort of describe perhaps holding a community or a town sort of hostage, like a terrorist would, in a sense, right? Terrorizing people. If you are now building up a reputation where towns and communities are fearful of you, in a sense, yes, I mean, you can be terrorizing a community. It doesn't mean you're a terrorist, right? So generally, when we're talking about terrorism now, we're looking at a pretty clean definition of someone who is engaging in, you know, usually acts of violence to get some sort of political or ideological movement moving forward even more.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, I don't know if he had that wherewithal to say, like, there is a big means to an end here, and hopefully I'm perpetuating this movement. But, you know, maybe we could say that's exactly what it was, even if he wasn't sort of, you know, planning that out as like, I'm the terrorist of the era or anything like that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the document I sent you earlier. It makes a very bold claim that he suffered from bouts of antisocial personality disorder. He was a psychopath. We're going to get into sort of the lack of empathy in a moment, but tell me a little bit about what antisocial personality disorder is.
First of all, let me clear some things up because you referred to this earlier, is that, and we used to think as in our profession, and really only until recently in the last, I would say decade, really have we understood that there's a biological basis for the emergence of personality disorders. So antisocial personality disorder is a diagnosis. It's within our field, it's in the DSM, and it is a diagnosis. Psychopathy is not a diagnosis. And Dr. Shiloh will elaborate on that. Mm-hmm. But overarching, it's a callous disregard for the needs and rights of others. And it's chronic and severe and ongoing throughout one's life. We have Fortune 500 companies that actually screen for antisocial personality disorder qualities in their CEOs because they want people that will take risks that you and I won't take. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I don't know, Chris, if you're a psychopath, you know, antisocial or not. You don't seem to be, you seem to be a very nice man.
Well, thank you.
But you and I might have a real problem in making a decision or pulling a switch that determines what the investments of billions of dollars in elderly people's retirements are going to be, right?
Yeah.
But CEOs have to make those kind of decisions all the time. We have certain categories of individuals who are drawn towards certain fields, certain professions are more likely to be antisocial. We have surgeons, you know, you need a steady hand and a really kind of cold intellect to be a wonderful, talented brain surgeon or heart surgeon.
Yeah.
Not saying that all of them have antisocial personality disorder at all, but a lot of them do.
Sure.
A lot of bankers, financiers, a lot of law enforcement have some tendencies. People who tend to be drawn towards authoritarian types of lifestyles can be drawn towards that. But it's not just this horrible traumatic event that causes a personality disorder. We used to think that. Mm-hmm. But what we know now is that there's actually brain structure and chemical structure within the neurology that all kind of comes to bear to whether or not a person will have the tendency for this personality disorder to develop.
Dr. Shiloh, thoughts on that?
When we look at our criminal population today, and of course we have numbers, better numbers now than we ever have. And Scott can also maybe speak to some experience here because he worked inside the prisons as a correctional psychologist. And then most of my work was working with folks that were coming out. So same population. He was just passing them on to me.
Different stage.
Yeah. Once they were.
Or you were passing them on to me.
Well, true. Because I did some pretrial stuff. So we just passed these folks back and forth. Yeah. But if you look at our prison population, especially for men, I mean, there's really high numbers, somewhere between 70-80% that we can say are diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
When we look at that and see the propensity for repeat offenders, that's also another area where Scott and I have done some work, is looking at the risk of reoffense. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to bring this up quickly because it kind of circles back to a topic we were talking about before, looking at like, okay, is there just this pivotal intersection where bad things happen to a kid or someone in adolescence and they make bad choices? And that's it, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're a lost cause. Certainly not. I mean, when we're looking at someone who has already committed a violent act, whether it be an assault, an attack, a homicide, or maybe something in the vein of sexual crimes, we look at multiple factors, factors that are certainly static, that do not change with time, that are just very similar to how like an insurance adjuster makes their risk assessments, right? Like if you're a teenage boy who drives a red sports car, sorry, buddy, you're higher risk and you have a higher premium, right?
Yeah.
So there are some factors like that that we look at with offenders and their past behavior, but there's also dynamic factors that we look at that can change for the better. Mm-hmm. And especially when there's some sort of intervention, when they do have to come to therapy or get involved in the system somehow and are on parole. And that's why we have systems like that. So what we do is we do calculations, taking into consideration the static and the dynamic factors that will put them at a risk level of low, moderate, or high risk to reoffend. They can be monitored accordingly. They can get therapy accordingly.
Yeah.
So those are a lot of the folks that we were seeing coming out of prison and in prison. When you look at psychopathy, that is, I always say it's antisocial personality disorder to the nth degree. Anyone with psychopathy would definitely meet the criteria for antisocial personality disorder, but it's not reversed.
Interesting.
It's antisocial personality disorder on steroids is psychopathy.
Wow. Well, and then I mentioned the lack of empathy earlier. I know it obviously varies from case to case, but for the most part, this dissolution of any kind of empathy, you know, with Jesse James, I mean, he's cold, he's murderous, but yet he's highly intelligent and he's out there politicking. He's working with people like John Newman Edwards and the media to sort of put a positive spin on his public image. And it works. People hide this guy and his gang, and he establishes like this really grassroots level reach. I asked this question once in the show already, but I really want to ask it again here. If you're Jesse James, what do you really care what the general public thinks of your actions? And then really more importantly, the behavior in which you commit them. It seems like it would be in direct polarization. Maybe not.
Not if he's a narcissist as well.
And he was.
But I'll let you take that, Scott.
Yes, sorry. That's a good point.
Let's be careful about diagnosing over 100 years ago.
Right.
But you do bring up a really good point. And the thing that jumps out for me in some of the research that was provided is that he thought of himself on the same level as Alexander the Great.
He did.
So that is really high self-regard, right? Mm-hmm. If he considers himself to be aligned or as impressive as the person who up until that point really put a corner on the entire known world, developed world, right? So that's what we would call expansive and grandiosity. Like there's an inflated sense of self. Part of it is how much of it is he getting off on the validation?
Yeah.
Look at what I can create. Look at who I am versus being a true believer.
That's a good point.
Let's all get on the same page and understand that slavery is bad. The Civil War, the right side won. There were horrible things that were done to enslaved people for hundreds of years. And yet he thought that he was on the right side of this argument, that this represented the way life was supposed to be, that I am this color skin and I am a fully realized human. And these other people, these other individuals are less than human. They are 3/5 of a man, which was what was established by law at some point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, we're not justifying any of his actions, but there's some grandiosity there that could come along with being narcissistic. The idea of empathy, that's a really hard one to plumb with all the space. Like, what do we have in how he treated people on a daily basis? Did he treat his fellow gang members as equals? Did he see them as less than themselves?
Yeah.
Did he torture and kill children? Mm-hmm. I mean, he did like inadvertently, like in one of his robberies, just shot a teller, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Just point blank shot a teller to death with no thought about that. So I'm just trying to point out that it's really hard to make a hard, fast decision on who he is psychologically, what his profile is like, because we have some conflicting information. That being said, those narcissistic statements really do point to an inflated sense of self. And when you have an inflated sense of self, you're more likely to see the world through the lens of what are my needs, how are my needs met, and what do I need to do to continue getting my needs met, which then leads toward, well, I need to make really good relationships with all these politicians and these newspaper heads. And, you know, he had the Civil War version of a publicist that turns him into Robin Hood, right?
Yeah.
It was like branding. It was like social media branding for its time.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's not the first time someone's mentioned PR in these conversations we've had so far for the show. Yeah, that's exactly what he had. And to your point, it's interesting because there's so much about him we don't know.
Right.
We don't know how many people he killed. We don't know how many robberies he was legitimately involved in. As I've said so many times on the show, his life was a smokescreen.
Yeah, that's very true.
We have a lot of sympathy and understanding for the child that has these ACEs. We have for the child that is abused, that is sexually abused, that is physically abused, that may have been physically abused so violently that they get a traumatic brain injury or get concussed a few times. And we continue that sympathy and empathy and compassion when the people that they trust, their parents, abuse them and use them. And then they find, perhaps they find, you know, one kind of shining light, stable relationship, and that person uses them in unhealthy ways, and it exposes them to violence and how to perpetrate violence, you know, deviant sexual activities exposure. We have so much sympathy for that child, but we don't have sympathy when they become Richard Ramirez, who experienced every single one of those factors or ACEs. Again, not justifying anything, but we have to understand that there's a lot that can happen to a child. And I did want to point out also one thing, and I don't know if this is necessarily relevant to the discussion, but it always jumps out to me because especially in the early days of looking through a psychological lens, and you know, the material that you sent us was written by a psychiatrist who is older. He is of a different generation professionally than I am, and he's now retired. But he spent a good few sentences with some kind of critical view of Jesse James's mom.
Yes.
You know, like it's very interesting that he points out that the mom is loud and she is sharp-tongued, but she's a strong woman, but she's this and she's this and this. There's a real slant as we do and we as that we have done and we're trying to move away from of framing moms as being so integral to who the man grows up to be. We used to even have a term for it called the schizophrenogenic mother, that we were trying to blame all moms for all mental illness.
Yeah.
In men. And thankfully, we've gotten away from that. But again, that's just a good reminder that we have to be careful about what is the lens that we're looking through when we're trying to understand human behavior, particularly when it pertains to violence.
Yeah.
I would like to go back to psychopathy for a moment and maybe give a little bit more explanation and hopefully add some context as we do talk about this like lack of empathy piece. And it is so much more than just lack of empathy, obviously. I mean, we're talking about deficient emotional responses across the board, as well as the poor behavioral controls. It's partly affect and how someone's thinking and how they're presenting, and then it's partly behavioral. It's not just one or the other. When mental health professional or a risk assessor fills out the one assessment tool that we do have for psychopathy, and it's one of the ways that we sort of label someone with that. And again, I'm not saying diagnose on purpose because it is not coded in our DSM. We look at a multitude of factors, and they have to meet a pretty high standard. I mean, there has to be a lot of these factors, and they have to be nearly present all the time for what they are. And just to list a few, for examples, the ones that would be more about affect would be glibness and superficial charm, the grandiosity, right? The big sort of sense of self, very manipulative, very conning behavior. And you do certainly have that lack of remorse or guilt and empathy, but the lack of empathy is also paired, as they list it on the assessment, as a callousness. It's not just like, oh, I don't care about this person. It is a cut off, cold, absolutely callousness. And they lack emotional depth. They can mimic it. They can learn it, but they don't feel it. that's sort of like what's going on the inside. What we would see behaviorally on the outside would be short-tempered, poor behavioral controls, a lot of impulsivity in their behaviors, frequent marital relationships, picking up and leaving their families without a second thought, and then a big variety to their criminal backgrounds. We do see that in antisocial personality disorder as well. So those kind of overlap, but I always call it the equal opportunity offender. They're just going to do what they want to do to whoever to get their needs met, right? So that's what psychopathy looks like. And again, I don't know that we can say Jesse James hits on all of those.
Sure.
We certainly get flavors of it, but the best research that we have now when it comes to psychopathy and the psychopaths that have been able to be studied in lab settings really comes down to a three-legged stool. And two of those legs are biological, and one of them is more situational and pivotal moments in their life. So for biology, you have a genetic component. It's sometimes called the warrior gene, but it's known as the MAOA gene that controls the production of a protein that breaks down brain signaling chemicals like dopamine, and that all influences mood. And that's really linked to aggression and antisocial behavior. They certainly have that marker we can look at in terms of genetic coding. When we look at brain functioning and brain imaging, this is what I want to loop back to lack of empathy. We can see that there are areas that are not lighting up in terms of situations where they should have empathy like the rest of us do. There's literally either cross-wiring happening or those wires are, for lack of a better term, kind of cut off. It's not just Jesse James or whomever saying, oh, I'm going to choose not to care about these people and I'm just going to treat them as victims and take what I want. Yeah. That just doesn't exist for him. So those are the two biological markers. The third marker that we now know about is severe childhood trauma.
He fits that one for sure.
Yeah, someone could very well have the two biological markers and have a wonderful childhood. They don't go on to become a psychopath. And I know I said it was really high numbers of folks in our prisons, particularly here in the United States, diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. When we look at psychopathy, it's about 20% of men in prison and 10% of women in prison who would meet criteria for psychopathy. So much lower.
When we sat down to cover the story for the show, the problem that we had sort of was just fitting, you know, everything in. We had to sort of pick a lane and stay there because this guy is attached to everything conspiratorial. Templar treasure, the KGC, the assassination of a still alive John Wilkes Booth. The list goes on and on and on. Are we just stuck on trying to turn this guy into like some kind of a hero? And if we are, is it our fault for romanticizing this guy's actions?
That's a really great question. And I think it's a wonderful thread of conversation. I don't know if it's our fault. I wish that we were a little bit more responsible at times with the information that we have available to us and that we took responsibility and had insight and understanding of consequences. But I don't know if it's necessarily our fault. You know, when you were describing him that way, it made me think of John Saint Germain. It's a really big conspiracy theory within the occult community that this guy, John Saint Germain, has been around for like 700 years now.
Oh, wow.
And what happened probably historically is that he kind of weaseled his way into a royal court in Germany back in the day. And he was so successful in conning everybody that when he retired to an estate and died, another con man came along and said, well, let me put on his wig and his clothes. And now I'm John Saint Germain. And then there's been all this mystery and mythos and legend that has built up around this guy. Jesse James is really the epitome of Western idealized culture.
Yeah.
As America was settled, we started creating this idea of what Americans were. And America is a bunch of things now, and it was a bunch of things then. But we have thought of ourselves for 300 years now as adventurers and bootstrappers and rugged individuals, right? Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that's kind of baked into our society now and why we're so really scared of words like socialism or social benefits or anything. It's because you're an American and you should be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so we love these stories of people that have come from nothing and achieve something, even if it's to the level of being an anti-hero like Jesse James.
Yeah.
I think that that's the basis of this myth. Building on top of it, the thing that sets all of this on fire is that we're in a time right now where people feel so unsure, even though these aren't really a lot of unsure times, there's a lot of facts out there about how things actually work, but people choose not to look at that. And they choose to see themselves in fear, being oppressed. What is the light at the end of the tunnel? Somebody that breaks all the rules, somebody that's an outlaw who says things the way they need to be said in a way. I just think that we keep coming back to this historically and cyclically, is that we go through these cycles where certain parts of our society need a hero. And it might be, for some people, it might be Taylor Swift. And for some people, it might be a politician, or it might be someone like Jesse James, who, whether or not he was a prolific serial killer as a terrorist, or he just happened to be there, and we don't know what the numbers are, except that, like, historically he was present at some very large mass events of death, right? People allow that bloody part to fade into the background so that they can still have this glowing picture of someone they can look up to, like, oh yeah, he was an outlaw, he was for the common man. And then you have to look a little deeper and you go, well, what common man was he supporting? He was supporting a way of life that completely crushed and marginalized the workforce of our entire country at the time.
We talked about this in the opening discussion of the show. You know, we've touched on it a little bit tonight, the amount of similarities between John Wilkes Booth and Jesse James, two very big narcissists. You know, it's par for the course for these types of people that are at the center of these cases. They both believed in what they were doing. They played it out to a certain extent, you know, victim's mentality in the public. We've heard the term Confederate Avengers, especially with Booth, you know, their true actions. It would be blanketed by this very positively perceived, very public side. For Jesse James, it's like this romanticizing and all the stuff that's going on with kind of him in modern day, like it's hiding, it's blanketing sort of what he did. And kind of isn't that what's happening in Jesse's case? Like, people, when they hear this, they're going to be kind of surprised of what this guy was, what he was truly like.
It's so interesting because it's like, I'm thinking of all these topics Dr. Scott and I have covered before and how he kind of fits in the middle of a lot of them. When we're talking about psychopathy, we're talking about narcissism, whether he meets those criteria or whether he just has a lot of traits that are the traits that history chooses to remember about him, I don't know. But it could all just really be this huge con. Like, if he's a master of manipulation, even if it's just manipulating, you know, sort of the PR aspect of it and spinning his story and watching all these people sort of lap it up and now make him the hero or anti-hero. But it's so funny because in the research, we find that with your classic con man, whether they're violent or not, there is really three things present when we talk about their psychological makeup, and they make up what we call the dark triad. So it is psychopathy. It's also narcissism. And the last piece is Machiavellianism. So it's this personality trait that really just denotes cunningness and the ability to be manipulative and really driven. I mean, there's a driven aspect here to, like, whatever means necessary, I'm going to be able to meet my goal. As I'm talking out loud here, like, yeah, definitely less of a terrorist. Maybe he's just sort of the ultimate con man. And those sort of intersect and loop over back into what, you know, we love to hear about: cults, conspiracies. It's why true crime is the biggest, you know, genre out there, like mysteries. Just as human beings, we love that. And I think that's been why he's sort of been reinvented and inserted into so many spaces and time in history.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mention a con man, because in the aftermath of his death, you have all these imposters start showing up saying, I'm really the real Jesse James. And you have people like John James that come on the scene. And then you have people like J. Frank Dalton, who we're going to be talking about in great detail coming up soon. It's interesting. It's ironic that Jesse James is still sort of conning people from the grave. It's kind of an interesting way to look at it, I guess.
Certainly is. Yeah.
Look at how we romanticized it, because I love, of course, Shiloh will laugh because I always have to pull some kind of crap like this out of my back pocket. But one of Cher's greatest hits, "Your heart is down for the count and you know you're going to lose it tonight. You're going to go down in flames, just like Jesse James."
Oh, there we go.
Just romanticizing that you're going to lose everything, but you're going to go out in such flames that everybody's going to remember you, which is what he did.
I'll ask one more final question and then we can wrap up. Jesse James's son became a lawyer, so he obviously didn't follow in his father's footsteps. Of course, Jesse's killed when he's around 6 years old. What does it say? Does it say anything that this wasn't the case of like father, like son? It ended up being a case of seeing a father's example and wanting to do better.
Yeah, it's that, if we can say that this is sort of a conscious choice by the child. But I would hypothesize that he was able to have you know, a really strong foundational support system around him that was able to model for him something that wasn't his father. Mm. And some of these traits, you know, some of these things we're sort of tossing around today, there is evidence that they're genetic. I mean, when we look at psychopathy and we're talking about biology, mm. that certainly could have been there. But I wonder how savvy of a shark he was as a lawyer. Maybe he channeled it that way.
Yeah, maybe. Dr. Scott, I guess, final thoughts of the night on that.
Again, the most important thing is the home environment. There are some things that the home environment can't control for mm. when it comes to biology. Certainly there are examples of that, but there are other examples where who knows who was whispering in his ear, you don't have to be like your father. You can be your own person. You can do this. You can do that. There's so much power that comes from that kind of parenting or that kind of support as a child. Mm. And I think about them, like even as another media example in The Sopranos, you know, his daughter is really the one that figures it out, mm. you know, after she wants to become attorney and all these attorneys are going like, you know who your dad is, right? You know who this person is.
Yeah.
She has to compartmentalize and put that to the side so that she can carry on with her own career. And she manages to continue to have a relationship with them. So there are amazing things that can be born out of the crucible of adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. Kids are savvy. Kids are way savvier than we give them credit for. I would go so far as even as a six-year-old, he could see all of the attention mm. that his father got, both negative and positive, and go, I don't want anything to do with that.
Yeah.
That's not what I want to have.
Yeah.
And kids can make those kind of decisions even at that early age and choose a path.
Part one and our introduction to the story is now over. History records that Jesse James was killed at the hands of Robert Ford on April the 3rd, 1882, in St. Joseph, Missouri. And that's how it stayed, for 70 years. But in 1951, a mysterious man, just short of his 104th birthday, would enter the story by way of Granbury, Texas. A man who told a pretty remarkable story. And if you visit Granbury today, you'll see his grave in their local cemetery there, marked with a tombstone bearing the name Jesse Woodson James. In part two, some of the most prolific experts in the world join us to tell us more about the man with no name, as he's been called. And we take the story of J. Frank Dalton to trial and put his claims to the test for good.
This is Chris Williamson. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media where we post each episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/vanishedpod, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @vanishedpod. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your co-hosts for Vanished are Jennifer Taylor and Chris Williamson. The show is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Vanished is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Vanished is a Chris Evan Films production. All rights reserved.